Get ready for a journey into the heart of Bridgeport politics with In Absentia, a new podcast from Connecticut Public's investigative team, The Accountability Project. Learn about the city's past and present political dysfunction and the systems that enable it. Tune in wherever you get your podcasts.
Funding provided by Francisco L. Borges and the Melville Charitable Trust.
This week on The Wheelhouse. Childcare. The crisis facing the sector. How and if we can fix it. For Connecticut Public, I'm Frankie Graziano. This is The Wheelhouse, the show that connects politics to the people. We got your weekly dose of politics in Connecticut and beyond, right here. For every $1 you invest in early childhood programs, there's supposed to be a $7 return in investment. An economist named James Heckman said that. But childcare is way underfunded. Lawmakers are promising change to this, but coming up, a conversation about childcare in Connecticut and beyond. But first, some breaking news. Joe Ganim appears to have won a Democratic Party primary part deux held yesterday in Bridgeport, Connecticut. A much-anticipated court-ordered redo resulting from allegations of absentee ballot misuse in September's primary. Along the way on The Wheelhouse, we talked to the candidates in Bridgeport, and we talked to a good friend who's followed it all. Investigative reporter for Connecticut Public's Accountability Project, Bria Lloyd. Good morning, Bria.
Good morning, Frankie.
So glad to talk to you. I saw you yesterday. More about that in a little bit. I saw you yesterday from beyond. But can you just quickly get into why there was a court-ordered redo as quick as you can here?
Yes. So there was a court-ordered redo because in the September primary last year, there were absentee ballot issues that came up, and that case had gone to court. And the judge ordered that the race needed to be done a second time.
And that led to a lot of scrutiny from even beyond local lawmakers and officials, but also local election officials. So there was some effort to watch over the primary yesterday. Did you hear anything about that effort yesterday? Did that become a factor at all?
I did not. That did not come up much yesterday.
And this latest contest, of course, months in the making here, election day more than 2 months ago, original primary in question 2 months before that. Do we got a resolution, Bria?
So there is no resolution just yet. So last night, as we know, Ganim won, but there's going to be another election on February 27th
another
as it
one.
Stands now. So at the moment, that is the plan currently.
And that's because if Ganim lost somehow, he would have had the new movement party. What about Gomes? Where can he potentially get on here for the general?
So Gomes can get on the ballot unless he decides to drop out. So that is what we are trying to figure out now.
And then David Hertz, I believe, would be the other party, the Republican candidate that they had that could potentially be there. Okay, so I did see you on television last night running point in a media scrum, getting that Connecticut Public mic up in the grill of Ganim. What did he say?
So last night, Ganim's big focus was they won on the machines, which is a really big deal for them because with this absentee ballot controversy, a lot of people said that that was a big part of the problem was, you know, how the Ganim campaign had previously won on with the absentee ballots. So they focused a lot on that last night and how they were, you know, surprised that they won on the machines, and a lot more people turned out to vote at the polls than they had anticipated. But they were really excited last night about that.
Anything yet from Gomes? What's John Gomes saying, who has been revealed so far to lose last night's election?
The last I checked, he has not conceded yet.
No matter what comes next in Bridgeport, it sounds like there may be an election on February 27th. I'm confident Bria Lloyd and Connecticut's Accountability Project will be following closely. Have a good day, Bria. Thank you for coming on the show.
Thank you, Frankie.
Going to switch gears now. The child care sector is in crisis, as we mentioned earlier, here in Connecticut and all over the country. Families are struggling to afford child care. Providers are making less than minimum wage. The quality of care is generally low. All of this can lead to negative impacts on a child's future. Connecticut's governor, Ned Lamont, tasked a panel of experts to come up with a plan to address this crisis in our state. With me now, Erica Phillips, an economic development reporter at the Connecticut Mirror. Erica, thank you so much for joining us this morning.
It's great to be here, Frankie.
So I just want to remind folks, 888-720-9677 is a number you want to call this morning. If you care about child care, if you're a provider, if you have your children in child care, if you just really care about children in general and their development, 888-720-9677, 888-720-9677 is the number, and we're standing by to take your call. So, Erica, Ned Lamont puts together this expert panel, a blue ribbon panel, to address some of the issues in this sector. What are some of the panel's proposed reforms?
Yeah, so I want to back up a little bit. And you probably said all this in your intro, but the pandemic was really this moment for the childcare sector when the rest of the economy, everyone else sort of realized, oh, we can't actually do what we need to do, get our jobs done, if childcare isn't taken care of. And, you know, the federal government recognized that there was hundreds of millions of federal dollars pumped into the Connecticut childcare system. Connecticut did a great job of getting that money out to providers and keeping programs open. We're one of the states that was looked at as a model in kind of how quickly we got that done and how much we prevented sort of the fallout, what could have been the worst fallout from all of that. But over time, you know, and as these federal subsidies started getting cut back because the pandemic kind of wound down, it became clear that there needed to be a longer term solution. And the governor said, okay, you know, I got a call in the experts in March of last year. He signed an executive order that created this panel that really is a wide range of folks from the business sector, from childcare providers, early childhood experts, parents, and so on, policymakers, to have a conversation and come up with it was a huge task, come up with a plan to overhaul the entire state childcare system and make it work better and make it functional. And a couple of the key things are to make sure the workforce is stabilized. So a lot of people who work in this sector are paid minimum wage. There's a threat that they could always go take another job where they're making more. It's really hard to keep people. And that means it's hard to keep enough capacity in the sector for parents who need childcare. At the same time, childcare is not affordable for most parents. So you have the other component of it, which is you need the workforce, but you also need funding to help parents afford it. So those are kind of the two key things that the governor wanted this panel to solve. And they are going about it in a pretty broad way.
This will come up, I would imagine, maybe as early as the next couple of weeks here, as the legislative session begins on February 7th.
Right. So they produced a report in December that lays out everything that they think would need to happen in order for the system to be functional. And it's a lot. There's a lot of like key action steps. There's things from, you know, everything from sort of making the systems work better, getting certification simplified for teachers, to, you know, raising pay, expanding slots, so on and so forth. And all of those things over the next 5 years are going to cost $2 billion if they were to implement everything. And that's money that would be coming from the state, coming from, you know, ideally federal sources, philanthropy, businesses contributing, and so on and so forth. So there's a big dollar amount on there. And the thing that everyone's kind of waiting for right now, like you mentioned, is, okay, there's this plan that's been laid out. Step one is, you know, the first year policy proposals that The governor would ostensibly put in a bill and present to the legislature, soon after they begin their session February 7th. What is he going to put in it, right? So of all these recommendations that this panel, busted their worked really hard to come up with this year.
You could say, but
what's going to end up in this first year's proposed bill? So it's a big question right now, Frankie.
Yeah, that is certainly a big question of how the lawmakers will come together and talk about this, what they might argue about. Obviously, I would imagine price is going to be a factor, but we will ask our analysts throughout the show to consider this. And I'll ask you first, $2 billion sounds like a lot of money. I believe the FY25, yes, we would start FY25 in July. I believe that budget is around $25.5 billion. So that might sound like a large portion, but put us into context here. We spend money on other things like, for example, public education, right?
Right, exactly. So I was trying to do some quick number crunching. Sometimes this stuff kind of makes your eyes spin. But, right now, roughly, Connecticut puts, I think it's just over $300 million toward childcare each year. The plan is a $2 billion plan over 5 years, and it's actually graduated. So in the first year, the amount is a lot lower than what you get to by year five, which is around, I think, $500 million, maybe $600 million or so. In year one, it's the additional programs would be maybe around $100 million or so.
But that's important. That's an important distinction right there. That's right. It's $2 billion over 5 years. So you're talking about $500 million towards the fifth year. Yeah.
Right. But once you get to that fifth year, that number would continue. I mean, it would need to continue at that level roughly. It's not going to be, well, in theory, all that money wouldn't just be coming from the state of Connecticut taxpayers. There's all this, it's contemplated in the plan, sort of what the sources would be for that funding, but that's one of the big questions as well is, how much our business is going to be expected to contribute. There's something, some of these plans call for kind of a split. There's sort of a public-private partnership where the companies put in a little bit, parent put in a little bit, the states put in a little bit, and they kind of share it. So that's one model that's being contemplated. But yeah, it's over 5 years, but it is not a small number.
That kind of, you talked about the pandemic and the importance of understanding this. This crisis was there before the pandemic, but obviously exacerbated by it when people realized that they needed childcare for their children. But just to give you an idea of how kind of fragile this situation is, you just made me realize it when you were talking about the numbers. This industry was stood up before rights and these stakeholders in the game were able to secure an extra $400 million during the pandemic. It was really stood up by just think about this, 0 to 3, 0 to 5 in Connecticut stood up by $200 million a year. When you factor in maybe $6.5 billion or something like that for K through 12, that's crazy, right, Erica? This is crazy that we're talking about it like this. I don't know. This is just just such a giant discrepancy.
Right. So and anyone who has a child under five, knows that discrepancy very deeply, because once you have a kid, it's sort of on you to pay for their childcare. 70% of the childcare sector in Connecticut is private. The other kind of situation that creates is parents who can afford it, often are the first to be able to get whatever open slots are available. If you think about someone who has to apply for care for kids subsidy, and in order to get that subsidy, you have to fill out a lot of paperwork. You have to show that you're looking for a job, or you're in higher ed, or you have a job. Sometimes that takes time to secure. So while you're spending all this time trying to qualify for a care for kids subsidy, whatever open slots are available are going to go to the people who can pay. So it creates another sort of disparity just in terms of who's able to access what's available.
I appreciate you talking about that disparity, because that's important here. It's not just about the cost of childcare for middle and upper class folks. It's important to talk about people that come from lower income backgrounds and providers really that are dealing with this issue too. But it's just when we talk about these numbers and we talk about the potential to get $500 million by year five, this $400 million that was kind of being floated around and was there at least temporarily during the pandemic, you could still go back to that time where there was only $200 million to kind of stand up this whole industry. So just getting back into the economic kind of considerations, this is your beat. What other things should we think about here if we don't fix the current issues?
The reason I jumped into covering this issue is, because when you think about childcare, it is an industry itself. It's also an industry that supports all other industries, right? So in order to have a functioning labor force, you need to be able, there needs to be a system where working parents who have little kids can get into the workforce. And in Connecticut, one in four working families has a child under six. So that's, thousands of parents that potentially could be filling a lot of the open jobs that we have in this economy, who, might have difficulty, being able, knowing what to do with their kid when they need to get out and about. There is, the childcare sector has a huge impact on the economy. And, I think about it that way there, but the childcare sector in and of itself is extremely important just for the development of children's brains. We can talk about it from an economic perspective, but it is also really important from a childhood perspective. Early childhood education is really important. And if you think about it, flipping that back to the economic side, if you're thinking about the workforce 20 years from now, you're going to have a more stable workforce if the babies that are being born right now are being taken care of and their brains are being developed. So there's kind of like, there's sort of multiple layers to the economic impact. It's certainly about caring for babies and making sure their brains grow. But there's so many other layers to the issue as well.
Capital Watchers, the Connecticut largest business association in Connecticut, the CBIA is watching this as well in terms of childcare being a factor here in the next session. So how realistic do you think it is that these changes will actually be implemented? Do you have any kind of idea on whether there will be opposition to funding childcare?
Yeah, I'm glad you brought up the CBIA. They actually, they were on the panel. They're among the people who developed this plan. And I asked the head of the CBIA, $2 billion, that's a huge number. And he said, it's a huge number because there's a lot that needs to be done. He doesn't have any, it seems like he is on board with kind of recognizing the overhaul and the systemic change that needs to happen. Now, whether that will translate to a overwhelming political agreement on these issues, who knows? And obviously the Connecticut General Assembly has some fiscal constraints. They put in some kind of, I guess we call them guardrails, but to keep themselves kind of on budget for the next several years. And that has often meant that social service programs don't get the funding that they're asking for. Whether childcare will be an exception to that, we just have to wait and see.
I'll be eager to talk to you throughout this session at some point to try to get an idea of what's happening. And then maybe by the end of it, when we're breaking this down in May, as it were, maybe we'll be talking about a new childcare landscape in Connecticut. Erica Phillips, from the Connecticut Mirror, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks a lot, Frankie. This was great.
Great to talk to you. And coming up, we're going to take a closer look at how the childcare sector has fallen into crisis and what's being done to pull it out of this mess. Want to hear from you, though. Join the conversation, 888-720-9677. You're listening to The Wheelhouse. We'll be right back.
Support for this podcast comes from Hartford HealthCare.
Elevating Health is funded by Hartford HealthCare. The FDA has recently approved Zepbound, a new medication for chronic weight management. Dr. Davida Umashankar, Hartford HealthCare's System Medical Director of Medical Weight Loss, tells us more.
Zepbound helps decrease hunger and increase satiety levels. Taking this medication for 72 weeks, people can see at the highest dosage approximately 48 pounds of weight loss. So definitely a powerful drug and another powerful tool that we have to utilize to help individuals who struggle with obesity.
For those ready to explore their medical weight loss options, Dr. Umashankar has advice on the first most important step.
I don't think anyone knows you better than your own primary care physician. So having that conversation whenever you feel ready is so important because these medications are quite powerful and do need to be monitored on a regular basis.
To learn more, go to ctpublic.org/elevatinghealth.
This is The Wheelhouse from Connecticut Public Radio. I'm Frankie Graziano. This hour, we're talking about the importance of quality childcare. Connecticut's promised to prioritize child care in 2024. We're going to see the impact of that in the next few months as the legislative session gets underway. It'll start on February 7th. With me now are two experts in child care and early childhood education, Melissa Boteach, who is the VP for Income Security and Child Care at the National Women's Law Center. Good morning, Melissa.
Good morning.
And our local education expert, Karen Liss, the founder of the Pre-K Leadership Program at UConn and retired West Hartford School Superintendent. Good morning, Karen. How are you today?
I'm great, Frankie. Nice to be here.
Very nice to have both of you here for a very important conversation. I want to start us off by playing a clip from my recent chat with Commissioner for the Connecticut Office of Early Childhood, Beth Bai. Here's what Bai had to say about the need for a blue ribbon panel and the current situation in CT. She said, where we are is we have a real workforce shortage, and we also have one of the biggest gender gaps in employment for women with children 0 to 6. And Governor Lamont is really interested in closing that gap and interested in making sure kids are ready for school. A little bit later on in our talk, while I was fumbling through a question, Bai pulled up a report to give me some national context. And she tells me that the Organization for Economically Developed Countries, they say that from what people are spending on children 0 to 3, the United States spends 0.4% of its GDP, where a lot of countries, maybe about 20 of them, spend at least 1% of their GDP. So people like Sweden, Melissa, Norway, Denmark, they're big spenders on childcare. What's the historical context here? How did the U.S. come to spend so little on childcare?
So the history of childcare in this country cannot be divorced from a conversation about race, class, and gender. Because originally, in the Industrial Revolution, we had a model mostly for white women where, men were working and women were expected to care for children as an act of love and not recognized as real work. And Black women, in the meantime, who were enslaved, were forced to care for the children of white plantation owners. And in Reconstruction and beyond, domestic work was one of the few professions that were available to Black women and later on immigrant women. And precisely because of who did that work and the expectations and history surrounding it, care work has always been devalued in this country and not seen with the same, it's been invisible. It's not been seen in the same way, even though, as our previous speaker said, it is the workforce behind the workforce. It is the backbone of the economy. It is the work that makes all other work possible. And so we've sort of gotten to this place through a toxic mix of racism and sexism. And as we go forward, we need to really learn the lessons of the pandemic and make sure that we are valuing care as the backbone of our economy.
When you brought up the image that I had in my head of the enslaved Black woman taking care of children, and we talked about race, class, and gender playing a factor in here, I thought about something that in a couple of years ago, I produced this show for Connecticut Public on child care in the state, early childhood education. And one of the things I talked with a child care director about was who has the power in this country, and it's usually these senators, these U.S. senators, these these white men generally who have daycare for their children. They have somebody to take, or they have some kind of au pair or something like that. So it still seems like today, all these years later, we still have an issue where the people in charge of this country don't really value child care in that regard. Does that make sense, what I just threw at you?
Yeah, I mean, people are bringing their lived experience to governing. And if you haven't experienced a child care crisis yourself, which the vast majority of people with children have, but very few senators or elected officials have, you're not going to understand the fact that the providers who love your babies and your toddlers and who are nurturing them and doing really high skilled work are making poverty wages. And meanwhile, you can't make your budget add up each month because childcare is taking up such a big part of it. That's the reality for most families in this country.
Well said. I appreciate that very much. Karen, how does this lack of emphasis given to early childhood, talking specifically from birth to age five here, impact children developmentally?
Well, if I could first speak as a grandmother, because what Melissa is talking about, I experienced through my family. I have a 2-year-old and 4-year-old grandchild, and they're in a childcare center, and there's been many changes of staffing. One of the people who will babysit for these kids, she used to work in a childcare center. She makes more money babysitting and dog walking than she did as a teacher in a child care center. So developmentally, we know that earlier is better. You cited Heckman's research, Nobel Prize winning economicist at University of Chicago. And so we know that if we don't pay attention to quality early child care, especially for children that are living in poverty, we know that 25% are more likely to drop out of school. 40% are more likely to become a teen parent. 50% are more likely to be placed in special education. 60% are more likely never to attend college. And 70% are more likely to be arrested for a violent crime. So over the long term, the cost of not providing early care is huge. So that's an important piece. The other thing we know is the neuroscience that has been well researched that shows the greatest growth in brain development comes in the early years, up to 5 years old. So if we want strong foundational cognitive skills in literacy, communication, and mathematics, and strong social and emotional competence, and consistent patterns of engagement in school and learning, self-regulation, we need to start as early as possible in developing those skills.
And what does the quality child care to get those results look like, to really take advantage of those developmental years that are huge from 0 to 5?
It takes compassionate, committed, well-educated caregivers, people who understand executive function and how to develop those skills in children, people who understand what purposeful play looks like, in other words, linked to learning objectives. And I'm not saying that free play shouldn't happen with young children, but there are ways of constructing play scenarios that benefit children even more. There has to be strong leadership that understands early development. One of the things that is happening due to the lack of available childcare in the private sector is public schools are expanding childcare. You know, the entry age for kindergarten has changed beginning in September. There's a lot of children that have September, October, November, December birthdays who parents are now going to have to either pay for childcare or ask for waivers to get them into schooling. So there needs to be even more attention to how we lead those kind of programs and understand how important that continuum is from early care into kindergarten, first grade, and up. It's a lesson in patience, I have to say, because it's not a quick fix. It's over the long term. And attention has to be paid to quality continuum horizontally and vertically across the curriculum.
Is it too early? I know this just happened in September, but I got to ask you this follow-up, Karen. Is it too early to understand what the impact has been of having this change happened. You now said that in Connecticut, you now need a waiver if you don't turn five by the time that you go to kindergarten to get into kindergarten. And that's resulted in people needing more child care for these children that don't turn five yet. Have we seen any kind of impacts yet?
I know there's been a tremendous amount of discussion among superintendents. I applaud those who are saying, you know, send a waiver. We want children in school. I also see it as a golden opportunity to expand pre-K in public schools, to create programs for these children, and see if they, in being in a preschool program, should they be moved into kindergarten, what is the effect of having programs within a school setting? Is that schools know the children better and can make better decisions about where they need to be placed. So, but I do feel there is an issue because there aren't enough spaces in the private sector to accommodate this large number of children.
Stay on your
Frank,
toes.
Go ahead.
So yes, you go ahead, Melissa.
No, I was going to say everything that Karen said is, I would agree with 100%. And I would just add that the fact that the connection between the child and the caregiver is one of the most important measures of quality. And when we are paying providers these low wages and they can make more dog walking than they can doing a job that they love caring for children, that connection is interrupted on a constant basis by high turnover in the sector. And that is a problem of quality.
I completely agree with you, Melissa, and thanks for bringing that up because that relational health piece is so critical.
You guys should be on your toes right now because you might be asked to reply to this first phone call that we have of the day. It came via the phone number 888-720-9677, and it comes from Sasha from New Haven. Go ahead. What's your question this morning?
Hey there. Thanks so much for having me on. I'm actually the president of the board of directors for a child care center in New Haven, Phyllis Bodell Child Care Center. We're an independent nonprofit center. We're set up to support families, especially women in medicine at the Yale School of Medicine. And I just wanted to say the Blue Ribbon Report really resonates with our experience. We're really lucky to have exceptional caregivers, and we want to raise pay and ensure they can stay with us. Over 90% of our budget goes to staff compensation at this point, and we still need to be doing more. But at the same time, we see that affordability challenge for our families. We provide tuition assistance, and we're not able to meet even 20% of the need that we're aware of, let alone families who might not apply because of costs in the first place. So I really just wanted to say that all the recommendations in the Blue Ribbon Report you've been talking about would be helpful to us, and we really hope the governor and legislature will take action in a big way this year, and particularly on things like the Care for Kids and other family-focused subsidies, as well as operational supports targeted to help organizations like ours improve our processes so that we can help better serve families. So just wanted to chime in that this is really important at the ground.
And Sasha, don't go anywhere yet, because I just want to ask you really quickly, if you can, before we let you go. What's the situation like there? What's the morale like?
I mean, morale overall has been pretty good. I have to say there are a lot of challenges for our caregivers this year from, COVID absences and the strain that puts on staff as folks have to be out to, weather-related challenges and transportation. Despite that, as I say, we have a really exceptional staff and morale is good. I think we as the board are trying to look ahead and figure out how to do all of the things that we want to do in terms of, again, compensation and making sure our teachers are appreciated in the way they ought to be, while still making sure that we're not fencing out folks who really need the services that we provide.
Sasha, thank you so much for calling. We hope you'll listen to the rest of the episode. Thank you so much, Sasha.
Thanks so much.
So there you have it. You have a provider talking to us about the situation in their child care center there in New Haven and talking about not being able to meet certain needs. What's your reaction to that call, Melissa? Or can you generally talk to us about some of the situations that providers are facing based on that call?
I mean, that call is emblematic of what's happening across the country. Every provider that we've spoken to has, as was mentioned, even before the pandemic, this was a fragile system with, almost no margins. And then the pandemic hit and blew the whole thing up. And the American Rescue Plan dollars, which expired on September 30th, that really helped stabilize the childcare sector, that expiration has made everything a lot worse. And there's going to be another tranche of funding that goes away in September of this year. And what we're hearing from providers on the ground is that, as the caller said, they value their teachers and they want to pay them well, and they value the families that are there, and they don't want to raise prices. But absent public dollars, absent investment in childcare and early learning in this country, there's just impossible choices that abound. The math doesn't work. Secretary Janet Yellen, our Treasury Secretary, said that childcare is the classic example, textbook example of a broken market. And when you have something that's a public good like childcare, where it's important for kids, we talked about the brain development and the educational component. It's important for parents. We talked about the ability for parents and especially mothers to go to work. When it's important for businesses because they need their workforce to be able to come and be engaged and productive. This is a classic example of a public good, and yet we have placed the burden of it squarely on the shoulders of overwhelmingly women and disproportionately Black and Brown and immigrant women to carry it.
Something that's going to underscore the quality talk is an email we received from Noelle. I've talked to Noelle in the past. She's very knowledgeable. She's very helpful to parents, particularly parents going through a lot during the pandemic, and also with providers, too, as Birth to Three will work with providers in the field. And she said that there's about 5 quality childcare centers that she would send her own children to, maybe in the state. So that tells you something right there. That's how challenging the situation is. And very important, again, Melissa, that you're bringing up, that this is squarely on the shoulders of women, particularly women of color and women from immigrant backgrounds. And we see that in people having to cover multiple shifts, right? Because if you have a home child care center, right, and you're open during the day, you might have to stay open pretty much all night as you have a second shift employee, somebody that wants to send their child to you in the neighborhood or something like that. But again, not impacting all families equally. Can you talk to me about a little bit more about who's impacted by this lack of funding?
Yeah, so rural families are actually very impacted as well because, over half of families live in what's known as a childcare desert. Childcare desert. Where there's just not enough licensed supply for the number of children under 6 in that area. And that is really acute in rural areas where there might just not be enough population to justify these larger providers. And so family care, friend, family, and neighbor care, home-based providers are really, really important component of the supply of childcare. Women of color, as you mentioned, immigrant women. And that's another thing actually that gets at the quality is culturally competent care is very important. There are a lot of providers who will be able to teach children in a bilingual way or in their home language, or providers who might specialize or be able to help children with disabilities. And you want parents to have access to a mixed delivery system where they can really have choice in choosing where their child is cared for and nurtured and educated. And because of the low supply, parents are lucky they can find anything at all, much less afford it. And so that is a problem across the nation, and Connecticut is no exception.
Rural families, just wanted to underscore that. Big problem that this Blue Ribbon panel is going to try to address is a lack of child care funding in Northwest Connecticut, specifically in Torrington, and then a really strong dearth of positions and available need in Eastern Connecticut. I want to explore why it's so hard to get people on board with the importance of funding this age group, Birth to Five. Here's a clip I'm going to play for Karen.
Brain development requires structure and routine, and high-quality childcare matters. And these other countries get that. Early childhood, according to Nobel Prize-winning economist James Heckman, is 13% of your return on investment. Who wouldn't take a 13% return on investment? The United States has not been taking it for decades.
Shocking numbers. How come they're not leading to more change, Karen?
I think it's hard for people to, a couple of things. One, I know that people pay a lot of attention to the money they spend in high schools. Sports, academics, getting students into college is very important. But as I said, this is a long-term view. When you invest early, you get a greater return over the long haul. The other thing that's interesting about Heckman's recent research is he's found generational legacy to the importance of quality preschool. So in other words, the children who are now parents and grandparents who've been through preschool programs understand the value. So I think we're building capacity, but the awareness of what we need to do and what it costs is critically important. I'm so grateful to Beth for leading this Blue Ribbon panel and for the governor for requesting it, because I think people just need to understand and hear the value. Melissa's data and insights are extremely important to understanding this as well. So thank you.
This is The Wheelhouse. I'm Frankie Graziano. Coming up, we're going to whip out our crystal ball and try to get an idea of what the future will look like if drastic changes aren't made to the childcare sector. And fast. If you're a child care provider with thoughts on this, give us a call, 888-720-9677. You're in The Wheelhouse.
You're listening to the new investigative reporting podcast, In Absentia, which means you're interested in getting to the facts and uncovering the truth. If you'd like to help us continue our investigative work, consider making a donation. Visit ctpublic.org/tapsupport and contribute today. That's ctpublic.org/tapsupport. Thank you for being a part of the Accountability Project.
So, you've never donated to this station before? That's okay. Public Media Giving Days are a great time to make your first gift. Here's how.
Give now at ctpublic.org/donate.
This is The Wheelhouse from Connecticut Public Radio. I'm Frankie Graziano. Melissa Botayok, VP for Income Security and Child Care at the National Women's Law Center, and Karen List, founder of the Pre-K Leadership Program at the University of Connecticut and a retired West Hartford School Superintendent, are joining us in this conversation we continue to have about the importance of lawmakers addressing this child care sector crisis we have in the United States. You can join the conversation as well. We've already had a caller here today, and we've also been able to read an email over the air, 888-720-9677, 888-720-9677. Ava Bermudez-Zimmerman, she's coalition director for a statewide partnership of stakeholders in early childhood called Child Care for Connecticut's Future. She tells me, Melissa, that Americans don't value child care as a public good, and that universal child care in Connecticut, and in particular, is possible with an estimated $1.5 billion investment. And she says, if you think that's a lot, consider how much the state pays for K through 12 education. She estimates $6.5 billion. So what do you think about that, Melissa?
So I think there's a couple of reasons why people have struggled to see it as a public good. One reason is that, you know, when your kids are really young, you feel it very acutely. And that's a time when you're not sleeping great, you're exhausted all the time. It's not the time when people have a lot of energy, usually for tons of political activism. And then all of a sudden you're in a different stage. And I think our brains protect us from remembering how hard that time was. And so we've been actually doing a lot of work to help people understand that throughout your life, childcare matters to you, whether or not you have small children. It might be that you want to have children and can't afford childcare. It might be that aftercare is, or camps are, summer care is a problem for you to afford. It might be that you are a grandmother who is being called in to help your own kids because they can't find and afford childcare. It might be that you're a business who's seeing it affect their workforce, but we really need to build the broad-based coalition to support these families and provide who are doing the amazing work on the front lines of building our childcare movement. And the second question about public schools, I would say put lots of money in public schools. Where what I worry about is that we're thinking in this scarcity mindset where we're pitting needed investments against each other instead of thinking about how we grow the pie.
Yes.
And I will say that, you know, there's going to be a big tax debate in the next year at the federal level. I know state sessions also have tax sessions, tax debates. And, you know, right now we billionaires, corporations, they're not really paying their fair share. Oxfam America just issued a report showing that the wealth of the richest people more than doubled since the pandemic. And yet here we are talking about really what is couch cushion money that could transform early childhood education. And so I think we have to really think about also tax debates as childcare debates and making sure that we are asking the wealthiest to pay their fair share so that we can make collective investments that help everyone.
And I'm sort of propagating this by talking about the comparison of K through 12. But the point is, a lot of K through 12 schools are asking for more money and they need help, particularly in alliance districts in Connecticut. Plus, higher ed is looking for money as well. So this is a shortage in education, and education is so important. So maybe it's more of a conversation here, as Melissa just outlined, of education from zero to forever, as long as you need it, needing the support. Just getting back to the Blue Ribbon panel in Connecticut, Bermuda Zimmerman, when I talked to her, said dressing childcare deserts existing in the state, like in eastern Connecticut, as I mentioned, early childhood curriculum and compensation for workers in the field. But she also says it doesn't go far enough.
We want the conversation to include the everyday Connecticut resident, right? If you are quote unquote working class, working poor, middle class, you're working paycheck to paycheck, or you just have enough to save for a vacation, how about you?
Karen, Bermuda Zimmerman wants the state to cap the household costs of childcare at 7% of their income, not just for some residents, but for all. Some of the Blue Ribbon panels, meanwhile, Karen, will begin to go into effect this year, some of those proposals. How optimistic are you about these changes, Karen?
Well, I tend to be an optimistic person, but I do think that we need to spend time educating the general population. The people that are voters, but don't necessarily have grandchildren, don't necessarily have children of their own, they need to understand that this kind of investment benefits everybody over the long term. And that takes one-on-one conversations. I'll never forget when we expanded preschool offerings within the district. I got a call saying, how come I'm going to be paying for daycare for kids? And, you know, it is these conversations where it's not about daycare, it's about child development. It's about the science of development. It's development of capable human beings that can contribute to our population. But as I said, I tend to be optimistic. And it's, again, just talking to people, helping them understand and responding to questions. I applaud you for having this program today, because hopefully it's reaching a good number of people and they will have better understanding and ask more questions.
If you are somebody out there that says that you care about the future or something like that, and maybe you talk about, for instance, maybe this crime situation that people point to that the numbers don't bear out, having support for children would allow people to succeed earlier in their life. So that is something that is very important. I just think about that phone call that you had, Karen, with somebody asking why I should pay for childcare. Maybe that's why. That's one thing. Melissa, we're about to end the show, but I want to give you a chance at a final thought. What do you think about what we covered here today and the future?
Well, I'm grateful to you for covering it, because I think we need as many people as possible to understand that whether they have young children or not, childcare is something that deeply affects them, even though it's been largely invisible and undervalued for generations, and that there are solutions. We don't have to settle for this idea that, you know, we find couch cushions and sort of put Band-Aids on everything. There is legislation that would actually invest long-term and sustained way in a childcare and early learning system in this country, and we need to build the political and public will to make that happen.
I'll say here as we close that Child Care for Connecticut's Future has a translated version of the Blue Ribbon Panel's proposal. Spanish language providers can check it out at childcareforct.org, and of course, families as well that speak Spanish. That's it for this important conversation on politics and children. Melissa and Karen, thank you so much for sharing your wisdom.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
Today's show, the very first one produced by my new partner in crime, Chloe Wynn. Thank you so much, Chloe, for doing this today. Technical producer, Kat Pastor. Thanks to Meg Dalton and Katie Pellico for helping us in studio today. Download The Wheelhouse anytime on your favorite podcast app. I'm Frankie Graziano. This is The Wheelhouse. Thanks for listening.